Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled. Hello and welcome to Pixel Sift. My name is Gianni. Pixel Sift is a fortnightly gaming podcast where we dig into all the news and all the goss and everything that's happening in the world of gaming. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Scott.
Hey, hey.
And Mitch.
Hey, what's up?
And joining us this week as well, we have Travis and Sean from Foregone, the Foregone Syndicate, with their game Desync. Guys, thanks for joining us today.
No problem, thanks, man.
Hey, guys.
So we're going to be talking all about your game a little bit further in the show, but before we do that, what else are we checking out?
Yeah, so we'll be having a look at the Frustum Culling incident and the fallout of what happened when Kotaku gave their readers a sneak peek under the hood of Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yeah, and on the tail end of today, robust character customization and rich stories. Lately, it seems that you can never have both in the same game.
All that and more coming up today on episode 69. Hey, now. Of Pixel Sift.
I'm going to leave that there.
Oh.
Pixel Sift!
It's not Pixel Sieve. It's Pixel Sift.
Pixel Sift!
Tuh.
All right, so an article on Kotaku sparked a bit of controversy last week when the angle they chose to focus primarily on game development technique known as frustum culling. Put simply, this is what happens when a game only renders what's in front of the camera instead of wasting resources on assets the player cannot see. Some indie developers are very quick to flippantly point out that frustum culling is not new or innovative.
Okay, so a bit of context, because I think it's not just the Kotaku article.
Yeah.
So Horizon Zero Dawn is currently having a documentary made about the process of making the game. Mm-hmm. One part of that was they did an interview with Kotaku, and they showed one little excerpt from the documentary, and it sort of visualized what frustum culling kind of does. It basically unloads things that the player isn't looking at to save on memory, to make it run better, all of these sort of things. This clip went huge. It popped up everywhere, and I actually saw it like pop up a lot of different places on normal Facebook, not game Facebook, and normal Twitter. It became really, became viral, right? So the response from some people after this was to say, hey, look, you know, people were excited about this, but this isn't a big deal. This is pretty standard. It's been in every game since 1985 or whatever. and we basically want to kind of discuss the reaction that some people have had to this sort of thing, and what that means towards the consumers, the players of your games, the media, and what it means for developers.
Well, I actually thought when I first saw the GIF, and I saw it on Reddit, and I thought, I didn't even take into account the fact that it was building everything and not rendering what was behind it. I thought that GIF was illustrating draw distance. And I didn't think that it was actually frustum culling was... I didn't even know what the term meant. I knew the concept. I was familiar with it. But I didn't know it had actually had a name. But I thought that they were just illustrating how far away the camera was rendering. I thought it was common knowledge that games just did that.
Yeah, to the somewhat informed, I mean, I wouldn't call us the most informed, but we're somewhat informed. You know, it is. But to your average person, then it isn't obvious. Like, the whole point of media is to be like an intermediary for delivering information to the uninformed. So I think it's silly that this turned into a fight at all, like, you know, and a bitch fest, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, media has a bad enough rep as it is. I don't think they should have jumped in and fueled the flames at all.
Do you know what? We're very lucky because we've actually got two game developers on the line here who can give us an insight into the mind of game developers.
Please do, boys.
Guys, what did you think of this when you saw this happen?
What's Frustrum Culling again?
Fantastic. Best question ever.
I thought, so...
But this is a perfect example. So, like, not everyone, like, you guys would be aware of the idea, and I'll let Mitch explain it because he's much better at it. But the idea of it being common knowledge to everybody, like, and is obviously not the case.
It's just not the case. Yeah. So, frustrum
culling. Maybe those guys are a bit of a gag, and they're actually, you know,
is maybe something.
Are you spoofing us?
So basically, it's the concept that's it's basically a concept that if something's not in front of the camera in a game, it doesn't have to be rendered.
Mm.
So pretty much it isn't rendered. So only what the camera sees, and the fact that you're moving through an environment and you're actually passing things is actually kind of an illusion.
Yeah.
So your context is only what's in front of you, and that's the only thing that's actually being built by the game.
Guys, do you think, I mean, there's probably heaps of things that are done to optimize a game and make it playable. Desync's a game that's very high speed, high intensity. You know, do you think it's better for people to kind of know how these things are made, how the you know, how many eggs go into the omelet, that sort of thing, or do you think this is kind of a big deal out of nothing?
It's definitely interesting showing people how complex games are. Do you guys remember the infamous video or GIF of Bioshock, where I think it was Bioshock or maybe it was Half-Life, where they have, I think you're inside a car and they actually just put the car on the player's head and they're
just jamming looking into through the ground. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It was really funny. There's definitely a lot of value in showing the behind the scenes of games. And I think with the article from Kotaku, it's sort of common knowledge, like Frustrum Culling in the development scene, but for most people, you know, it's still really interesting. So I think there's definitely a lot of value, but I can understand the reaction to it, where there are a lot of new, more modern techniques, a lot of things going on in the indie scene that could have gotten more coverage. But you know, for most people and, you know, laymen, it's Frustrum Culling is still pretty interesting.
Yeah,
just the fact that it was like some, like a journalist from Kotaku sort of thing. Like, you would, people maybe have like expectation that people know like what that is sort of thing. Like you were saying before, that like the average person doesn't know what Frustrum Culling is, and like that's true, and like that's fine. This is like a journalist saying it kind of thing. So it's not just like everyone doesn't, like this, like a random doesn't get it. It's people, I guess developers were probably coping with it. They had like a little bit more insight into like what they're writing, that kind of thing.
So do you think it was an expectation that from on the journalist or the expectation on the audience?
I'm saying that it was an expectation on like the people, the developers that replied, like however they did, expectation on them that like the journalist should have known what it was.
I think it's speaking from sort of our perspective, I think one of the things that is really interesting is that whenever you are told to write articles and do radio stories and all of that sort of things, you have to kind of expect that the person you're talking to is in about, they say, a 9-year-old, so in a year, like year 2 or year 3 sort of, and you pitch it at that level and then you add complexity as you go along. So I think that some of these concepts may, you know, be something that people may know. You know, there may be a particular audience that obviously would read this thing and say, yes, we know this is a pretty common term. But you have to write. It's you see it a lot. You write for the lowest common denominator.
Exactly that, because you don't know who's reading you.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting about this is this was this big conversation about, you know, there is sort of like different levels of expertise, and there is the conversation we always have with people is there's an expectation that players have. And, you know, people say, you know, oh, why can't you just chuck a multiplayer in your single player game and just, you know, it's only going to take 3 weeks or whatever, you know, and that this conversation sort of needs to happen so people see the nuts and bolts behind the scenes to work out exactly what kind of, you know, what is required to make a game.
Also, it is Kotaku. I mean, it's not like it's a news aggregate. They also have another thing on the same website that's like, why do cockroaches like to nest inside PS4s? They also have something like that on the same website. I mean, it's not like it's a professor at DigiPen writing a peer-reviewed article. It's not even a Gamer Sutra article or anything like that.
No, exactly. Your Kotaku readers are generally gamers, not developers. Yeah. So yeah, no, and just your general kind of consumers of gaming things. So I don't know. This kind of information is great, I think, and I was kind of really happy to read it and learn about it, even though I knew the basic and I knew it existed, but I didn't know it was called that. And I didn't know, you know, the inside information. I thought it was good and refreshing, and I didn't really see why there was such a backlash. And I do understand, like, you know, there's lots of, like you said, like you guys said, there's lots of indie developers doing way more amazing stuff than this. But, you know, it's that doesn't take away the fact that this is an amazing thing on its own, and it does deserve to be, you know, spoke about.
Where do you guys go if you want to find out, like, you know, cool techniques and what sort of sources are you using for your information?
Yeah, sorry, I definitely can't tell you that. That's really
creepy. Back alley secrets, yeah.
Yeah. You can't just get that, guys.
No, if I didn't tell you, but I'd have to kill you.
I don't know any offhand, you know. Where do you go?
Pixelsif.com.
Gunsif is pretty hit and miss. Mm-hmm. But like, it has like good stuff on Gunsif with the forces and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty out there.
Get on the internet, what I'm hearing. Just do a Google, how to make game.
For all the negativity, you know, Twitter is a great place to get lots of cool little ideas. You follow the right people, you get lots of inspiration on Twitter. And
yeah.
People post like little articles or little tidbits, and you can read more into it if you have the time. So I think Twitter is just a nice, you know, encapsulation of all the cool things that are going on sometimes.
So a lot of things you're trying to find, like, real specific sort of thing. Like, you might see someone do something really cool, like, on Twitter, like Sean said, and then, like, you're like, oh, like, how does that, like, happen? Like, I want to, like, learn more about that, and then, like, you kind of just Google it for yourself sort of thing, and then go, like, down there. It's not so much just, like, here's one website telling you where all the cool things are sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's more just, like, you, like, talking to other developers and seeing, like, what's out there, and then going from there, your engine.
And if you can handle it, Reddit, I guess.
Yeah. Start the conversation with someone.
I definitely not Reddit. No. Ugh.
Uninstall. Unsubscribe. Look, guys, we're going to hear all about how you guys have made your games. Right now, though, we're going to jump into the next topic.
Watch episodes, let's plays, and more at youtube.com/pixelsiftau.
So if you just tuned in, joining us over the internet is Travis and Sean from the Foregone Syndicate. They've just released a game. Well, 2 months ago they've released a game, and they're still working hard on it. The game is called Desync. Guys, if people haven't seen your game, what is it, and how would you explain it?
Hey, cool. Desync is an FPS game that we built to try and bring people into playing FPSs at a high level in a single player, you know, safe environment. So it's a score-based, leaderboard-driven FPS set to like a really sick synth soundtrack. It's notoriously difficult. It's really challenging. It has a lot of mutators and modes and all this sort of stuff. And we love it, yeah.
So it's basically the gateway drug into your competitive multiplayer.
Yeah, I figure if you play Desync and you finish it, it's basically a gateway into Quake Champions coming out, I guess.
So I first saw the game at the first RTX, and I think that was at the end of, I want to say the tail end of 2015. I think was that, I think that was that that year.
Yeah.
How long had the game been in development at that point? Because it looked like it was ready to go on Steam then.
All right. Well, yeah, to me, that was about 2 years, and we're glad you think that because we hit a lot of the other stuff that wasn't quite so ready away from everyone. But it was 2 years at that point, and it took us about 3 years to make total. And it was just, we had like the initial concept. I'm not going to say down because of the constant like just progressing with it, like seeing what sticks. Kind of just like not like throwing things in at the wall and seeing what sticks, but it was like always building upon like what we had sort of thing, but like a longer process than we could have ever believed.
We had a really organic development. We, you know, we had the set idea and we had the feeling of what we wanted players to go through when they played the game, which is kind of like a obscure hatred of the, you know, themselves. Not really, but we had the idea of what we wanted to make very early and the feeling of what we wanted to get across. And as we were making it, you know, we would just have so many ideas and, yeah, like Trav said, throwing things at the wall and seeing what stuck was basically our development. But we built the game in such a way that it was just such a big web of mechanics that all worked together. It wasn't modular in the way we could just add a feature here, add a feature there. Everything had to work together to feed into the score system and the progression. So whenever we added something or tweaked something, it would affect everything and it had to work all together. So when we hit that 2-year mark, when we met you guys, it was, you know, we had the platform down, we had everything down, and then it was a matter of building out the content. And we're really perfectionists, and we kept raising the bar of graphics and sound. And every time we did that, everything else in the game had to then escalate to that new level we came up with. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. We get that a lot. Like, the people thought that the game was ready like a year after we were making it, and then we still had 2 years to go, sort of thing. So I guess it just goes to show, you know, something about game development.
How do you guys go through that iterative process? Is it important to get it in front of other people who are playing the game? Do you play test a lot locally? Like, how do you go from, okay, we need to make this change, we need to go to this, we need to adjust this particular element?
Yeah, that is an awesome question for us, because the game that we made is it's not for everybody. So getting the game to as many people as possible wasn't our goal, because the feedback that we would have got and that we did get when we did do that was always, you know, the feedback that we knew we would get was obvious stuff that we were actually trying to avoid. So we had a, maybe it worked to our detriment or to our reward, but we didn't have as much play testing as most other games, because we kind of knew the vision of the game we wanted to make. But I would say for most games, getting the game out to as many people as possible constantly is probably ideal. And feeding that feedback through what you think the game should be is definitely ideal. But we had a specific vision that we wanted to execute before we really got it out there too much.
So was it all internal that you guys were having the sort of feedback and testing and everything? Or did you have some people who were like in on the vision, understood what you were trying to achieve? I'm just wondering, did you bounce it off anyone, or did you test anything? Because I know when you do anything creative, it can be difficult sometimes, especially when you're working on it a long time, to know whether you're making progress or whether you're kind of standing in one spot.
Yeah, it depends like what stage of the development we're at, sort of thing. Like, the first year was really just like super internal, barely like threw it to anyone. The like second year, we had like a couple of people we like trusted with the game to give us like valuable feedback based on like where's the game's at, sort of thing. And then like the later on, the more people we like try to throw it at. But also like we met you guys at PAX and like events like that are really helpful for just seeing like what the general like person playing the game, like how they're gonna go. Like, we didn't know how long it would take someone to beat like the first level until like 2 years after we actually made the thing and took it to like a PAX for the first time, sort of thing. So stuff like that is super valuable.
Yeah, those events for us were really our playtesting a lot of the time, because we didn't really send the game out to the public or to a wide array of people. But those events really for us were testing. We just had our notepads out watching people play constantly. And just to what Travis said, have to give credit to our publisher, Adult Swim, because they in the later stages had a lot of feedback and they play tested the hell out of it later on. So they really helped out too.
You kind of guys mentioned that it was sort of a game that you couldn't just put in front of every single person and you know, just wouldn't be something that everyone would be able to get immediately. Did you worry at any point that you were making too niche of a game, that it might be only a small number of people who'd be interested in playing it? I mean, the dream is to kind of get it to as many people as possible, but was that something you were thinking about, or is that feedback that you had?
Honestly, we were so focused on just executing the game, I think, that we wanted to make, that we weren't too stressed about if it was going to be niche. I think people probably kept trying to tell us that it's niche, and in hindsight, maybe we should have listened to them, but we just were still in the midst of, you know, executing on what we wanted the game to be. So whenever we would get feedback that it's too niche, we would always react like, yeah, we haven't implemented this thing that will make you think this, and it'll subtly hint you to do this. And so that's the reason there, yeah.
But like, just one thing, like, we knew, like, throughout development, we kept telling ourselves, like, this is a niche game, some people aren't going to like it. It's like meant to be really challenging. It's kind of like alienating for some people if you're like not played FPS games before on PC. And then like actually seeing that after release happened was like just like a little bit weird to see. Like, we kept telling ourselves throughout development, like, that's how it's going to be, that's how it's going to be. And then to like actually see it happen, it's just like, yeah, it's like, it's exactly what we said, but it's like mildly annoying.
Annoying.
That was the case.
So you guys mentioned Adult Swim earlier. That's not really a company that people traditionally associate with games. How did that relationship kind of form?
Well,
between
that's
you
not
there?
True, Mitch. They do a lot of games.
But they do, but like you said, they don't traditionally align the two together. You know, well, I mean, they're an American kind of broadcasting network. Are they not classically?
Yeah.
So yes, I think that's a fair question. There are Outwit games. Yeah, but
you want to go, Johnny?
Yeah, what the hell? Messing up his flow.
Sorry, we actually got that a lot. Whenever we'd say, or whenever people would see Adult Swim, I would say 80% of people would be like, what? They do games? What?
Yeah.
How did that come about? How did you guys,
good
connect
question,
to that?
Johnny.
You know, it's really interesting because Adult Swim, before we hooked up with them, weren't big into doing like the scope and quality of games of that we were making, I guess. Like, they were more doing what, like Zenzy Zenic, you know, kind of flashy kind of games.
More flash, like widespread appealing kind of thing.
Yeah, so they were doing like that sort of stuff, and then they just caught us at the right time where they were branching into. Right after they saw us on Steam Greenlight, they were branching into, I think, more, you know, real games, challenging games, real games. Not, you know what I'm saying. You guys know.
Bit of pocket Mortys.
Different sort of genres, I guess.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. Yeah. And they just caught us at the right time, and they were doing things like Rise and Shine and Rain World, Headlander, and all these like more advanced games from, you know, legit devs were coming out, and they caught it at the right time. So it went really well. I think we talked to them for so long before we finally said yes. They courted us. They courted us for months and months.
Quite hard to get.
We played very hard to get.
Fruit baskets, rose pillows, and all that sort of thing.
But go on, Jeff. What do you reckon?
We talked to had our green light go live, they just emailed us, and then we talked, just went back and forth about 6 months sort of thing, maybe even more, before like signing with them. And then after that, they like announced us on Twitter, and that was like really cool to see like us with them. And yeah, from then on, it's just been really smooth sailing too.
Yeah, totally smooth sailing. It was interesting going from like this is just our little game post uni. We had kind of no expectations. We were just trying to make a thing, to then having a publisher that gave us the knowledge that we knew the game would at least be exposed to a lot of people. And that was a big difference. Yeah, going from just this is our little homemade thing to like, oh, this is actually going to be sold and exposed to a lot of people is daunting and inspiring.
Man, what's it like looking at the catalog of Adult Swim? It's Rick and Morty, the simulator virtual reality. And then only about two rows down is Desync. That's pretty cool.
Well, Trav's the big Rick and Morty fan.
I don't know if VR thing to play Rick and Morty.
You wore the Rick and Morty shirt to PAX, man. No, you were repping.
I shouldn't pay for that.
He's on brand. He's
he's on brand.
I just buy that myself. Like, what the hell? But it's crazy to see us up against like all those other games and seeing like what's coming out with like Rain World just got released and like Death's Gambit. I mean, like, I played like Volga the Viking, like, was a game they did ages ago, and like I played that before like they even emailed us about like things. It was really weird just to see like a publisher of a company that like you've heard about before and like played some of their games. And like Super Hazard Dead Ninjas as well was like a really cool one like back in the day. So it's like just surreal really to see us along, or even just like getting emailed by the publisher of them being like right next to all the other games.
Just before we jump onto the next topic, guys, we've just got a question from the Twitch stream from Pretty Fly for a Shy Guy. How long does it take to get a game project from general concept to close to completion or testing?
Wow. So it's we're a bit biased though, because we started making this game. It was called FPS 2014 because we thought it would come out in the year 2014. So
nice.
We were kind of new to the engine we were using, so we were learning as we went. So it's up to your skill level, how much experience you have, what your expectations are. But for us, we were kind of experienced programmers and kind of knew exactly what we wanted to execute in terms of feeling. It took us around, 4 to 6 months, I would say, before we had the some form of gameplay and like our systems in place, and then we got onto Steam Greenlight, had a pretty strong Steam Greenlight. So, you know, it was like a month to 2 months for some general gameplay, and then messing around with that and fixing that up for about another 2 to 3 months until we got on Steam Greenlight. Yeah, so around, I would say like 4 to 6 months. Yeah.
Cool.
Take some time to get to the point, and you've reached the finish line now, or have you? You're still working on it, chipping away at your baby, as you said it was. If people want to give your game a go, where's the best place for them to head to, and what sort of things should they bring into it when they're just about to sit down and play some Desync?
Yeah, so go check it out on Steam. It's currently, you can go buy it there now. We like released 2 months ago, but we're still working on it now. Like, you can go on like our forums, we're like active in there responding to feedback, like changing, balancing things and like adding new features. Like, we're implementing some things that didn't make it into release, and got some new ideas beyond that sort of thing. So if you want to check it out, just go onto Steam, and if you're just be ready for a challenging FPS that throws some new things at you that hopefully that you haven't seen.
Great.
Hell yeah.
Thanks, guys. We will stick a link up to that as well. So right now, though, we will jump into our next topic.
Visit us on pixelsift.com.au.
So lately, there have been many examples of games with strong character customization tools, but lacking a strong narrative. Games like Destiny that allowed players to change everything from their appearance, weapons, and even core ability sets, but lack the strong story elements found in games with more options. Now, there's plenty of examples from both sides out there. Do you have some thoughts on this? I'm sure you do.
Oh, look, I think this is one of these interesting topics that there's two different types of narrative, and we've talked about this before. Well, there's more than two different types of narrative, but, you know, there's predominantly two that you talk about. You have like a story-driven narrative where someone experiences a story that they go through, or there's like a player-driven narrative where you have a customizable game and you go, and the traditional role-playing game is that you're making the story yourself, and there's a few little story hooks in there, but it's about how you sort of play the game. Interestingly, this kind of we kind of came at this because we were talking about the customization, and we're talking about especially in games like the one I remember really keenly is Final Fantasy X, where in all the previous Final Fantasy games, they let you name your character. You can call them whatever they want. But they were text-based games. There was no voice acting in it. But in Final Fantasy X, they let you name your character. You can call him whatever you want. But the game is fully voice acted, except for like some sections which aren't. And they would just refer to you as, hey, the new guy, or hey, star of the Zanuck and Abes. And it was really weird. Like, it was a really strange thing, because obviously they had to accommodate for you to call them, you know, Buttface or whatever you wanted to call them. but yeah, it just sort of seemed like that choice was given, and it actually took away from the story.
You know, it would be great if all the characters were kind of acted like they didn't know your name and they were trying to find it out for the whole game. Like,
they were just like having an awkward party, and they're like been talking to someone for ages. Yeah. And
who invited that guy?
Too far now to like ask. It's just being impolite. Ian Bogost as well wrote an article this week where he said that video games were better without stories. And he says it's a long-standing dream that video games will evolve into interactive stories, like the ones that play out fictionally on the Star Trek holodeck. But we're not at that point yet, and it's better to just have free-form play and all that sort of thing. So,
I think there's... I guess there's a couple of views of that opinion. Look, there's lots and lots of good stories, games out there with strong stories, and they tend to do quite well, I think. You know, your Last of Us and whatever like that. They tend to be huge, really popular, and really well taken. But they're not the majority. The majority of games are like you said, the Destinies, or the even what's the new Ubisoft one, Ghost Recon, is a perfect example.
You've got to think even broader than that. The majority of games that are coming out now are mobile games. You know, the vast majority of them,
If
and
we're
they don't
about different-
have. Yeah. You know, most of them will be sort of small repetitive gameplay loops, and it might be fun telling your friend about what happened in, you know, Clash Royale or whatever. But that is the vast majority of games, and that the experience is something that you give fun in a different way rather than storytelling.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's an interesting concept. What do you guys think about this? Is this something that you think is important to games? Would you prefer to have the ability to make a character be what you want it to be?
I think, like, some of my favorite games have stories and have, like, a whole team of writers, and, you know, think of, like, Metal Gear Solid without a story, right? like some of the best games have stories. I think there's merit to the idea of, as the video game art form, what's the one thing that video games do that, you know, reading and movies and stage plays and all that things don't do, and it's interactivity. So
exactly,
there's a merit to the idea that like the objective peak of a video game narrative would be everything is systemic and driven by interaction and how you interact with the space, rather than scripted events or things that borrow from movies and scripted cutscenes and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, you're right. It's its own medium. It shouldn't try to lend from film or whatever, because it can do its own thing, and there's a reason why it exists, and there's a reason why it thrives, is because of that, yeah, interactivity and the immersion that you get from games that you only get from really great films, I guess.
You gave the example of The Last of Us a little bit earlier, Scott, but yeah, that is like a multi-million dollar game. There is teams of writers and actors who are working in motion capture, okay, and all of that sort of thing. But then you have the other side of the coin where you have small studios like, for example, No Man's Sky, which was it was quite algorithmically driven. And even Minecraft and things like that, the early levels of Minecraft, like there isn't an overarching narrative, but that's a player narrative that kind of comes from there. So, you know, I think you could jump on either side of this and be like, yeah, well, I'm right if I do either or.
I'm going to be on my own here, but as much as Last of Us was great, I felt like it was a bit shit. And like,
and that's all we got time for, so Scott's off the show.
It's like they just held my hand the whole time. It was like, hey, here's this really good story, but we're going to like throw some game in it. That's how I felt. It was like all the good gameplay. Exactly. There was not a lot of good gameplay. They held my hand and walked me through it all. It was
so like, if you would like
this
to...
This is great, but like... It's not the game I want to play. I kind of want to turn this off and, you know, play anything.
If you would like to apply for the presenter's position at PixelSif, you can send an email to Scott. No.
Send your hate mail to scott@pixelsif.com.au. Tell him he's wrong.
I feel like the budget aspect and regarding storytelling, I mean, we know one-man studios that have pretty good stories. Like, there is, like Dust and Elysian's Tale. That was a pretty story-driven game, and that was made by one person.
Mm.
And Jacob Janerka, one of our person that's
Paradigm.
Been on Pixel
Paradigm.
Yeah. Paradigm.
Massive.
And that has that's pretty much a story.
Yeah.
But that's a game that took a long time to build. And, you know, there's all sorts of different, you know, trade-offs with all of these things. You know, a game where you have a fully... I mean...
There is no black and white.
Let games
it's
be games.
Gray. It's
you
all
know?
Grey.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Can't fall down on either side of this one there. It's a conversation that I think we will continue to have into the future, and people will say you're wrong on the internet regardless of whatever you say.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to live up that Last of Us.
Yeah,
I
know. Jeez, Scott. I wish I had.
I'm getting the finger from
I'm
everywhere.
I'm really reconsidering a whole lot.
It doesn't play out on radio very well, but...
Look, that's all we've got time for tonight. Thank you for joining us on Pixel Sift. We do this every fortnight. We do Let's Plays every other fortnight, so basically it's every week. And you can find out all about these topics. You can talk more about this. You can meet great people like Travis and Sean from Forgone and learn about their games. If you want to find out more about our stuff, we are at www.pixelsift.com.au. Mitch, we've got a stack of other episodes.
Yeah, you can go to our website to stream episodes. Subscribe to as a podcast on either Apple Podcasts, it's not iTunes anymore, Pocket Casts, or using the RSS link on our page. And if you previously subscribed with the RSS link, you might want to give that another hit, because we recently changed where the podcast is hosted and it may have unsubscribed you.
We don't know.
Sorry,
maybe
we don't know.
Who knows? Maybe you won't hear this, so you've been unsubscribed and we just think the show is finished. So anyway... Scott, if people want to find out all the stuff that we're doing, including updates and, you know, previews of what's coming up.
Yeah, get all the things at facebook.com/pixelsift, twitter.com/pixelsift, twitch.tv/pixelsift, and youtube.com/pixelsiftau.
Thanks, guys, for joining us. We've been Pixel Sift, and thank you, Travis and Sean. We will catch you guys next time.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Laters.
See ya.
Thank you. If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.